You know, the last time Amy Stewart was with us, we talked about insects and dangerous bugs that are around us. This time, though, we're switching gears to something that perhaps a more pleasant topic, and it's about her book. It's called The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. And I'm telling you, I'm having so much fun reading through this book. I haven't read the entire book yet. I'll be honest about that, but I've read a lot of it. And you know what? I keep finding that I'm saying, I didn't know that. Where'd that come from? About plants and about drinks. So it's, and Amy is so much fun to talk to. It's great to get her with us. She's actually joining us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Milwaukee. She's got an event tonight. We'll talk about that event that she's got in Milwaukee. You can participate in that as well. We'll get you information about that, but let's bring her on board. Amy, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, it's nice to be back. It's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been a while. You have such an engaging way to talk about natural history. Where does your passion come from for that?
Well, you know, I think I'm just sort of naturally curious about the natural world and the scientific world, but really, all of these books have, in some way or another, been about people more than plants or more than bugs, and that's what's really intriguing to me. I mean, you know, a plant growing alone in a jungle is just sitting there being green, right? But when somebody comes along and figures out how to make a drink out of it or figures out how to kill somebody with it, then you have a story, right? So I'm really interested in telling those stories.
Well, and your beginning story in the book as to how you actually decided to write this book, it's a great story in and of itself. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, how
did you get to write this book?
Right. I mean, like many ideas, this one started in a bar.
Yeah.
I was sitting with a friend. He had this bottle of gin somebody had given him, and he said, "You know, I'm just really not interested in gin. It's never really been my thing." And I said, "How can you be into plants and not be fascinated by gin? Because look at all the different plants that end up in a bottle of gin. I mean, not just juniper that we know about, but, you know, coriander and citrus and cardamom. I mean, so many strange and diverse plants in one bottle. And when you think about it, and as I was looking around at all these other bottles, I said, there are nothing but distilled plants in all of these bottles. Like, isn't that interesting that that's all it is?
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
And your book, what have you got, about 150 plants, something like that?
Something like that, yep.
In the book. So, well, talk about how's your book organized? Let people know.
Well, so here's what I decided to do. I decided to follow the process that the plants themselves take to end up in your cocktail glass at the end of the evening. So I start out with plants that we actually ferment and distill to make into alcohol. So that might be sugarcane, agave, rice, apples, grapes. And then I look at all the plants that a distiller might add during the process to change the flavor. So that could be hops in the case of beer. It could be juniper in the case of gin. All kinds of fruits and herbs and spices that go into the bottle, that are in there during the bottling process. And then the last part of the book are the things that you might grow in your garden or get at the farmer's market to actually mix into a drink, to make to garnish or to use as a mixture to make a cocktail.
And I think it's a great way to organize the book. I love how it's set up. And again, as I said in the beginning, so many times I'm reading it and I'm, oh my gosh, I could, or either I'd forgotten it or I thought, I didn't know that.
Right.
Let me think of an example. Sweet potatoes is one. You know, and you start right out and say, well, it's not a potato. It's related to a morning glory. And
right.
they're not potatoes at all. And you talk about how they're used in Mabi.
Yes.
I spent quite a bit of time in the Caribbean, and I taught for a year at the University of the West Indies. Mm-hmm. And Mabi was a drink down there that I had many a time.
Oh, okay.
And it goes back, way back.
Yes, it does go way back, and used surprisingly around the world. I mean, there's a I don't know if you've ever had shochu, which is Japanese. The Korean version is soju, which is about 25% alcohol, so a little bit stronger than something like sake. But in addition to making it with rice, they also make that with sweet potatoes. And it's a really interesting flavor. I have a bottle of it at home. As you can imagine, I have a bottle of a lot of things at home. But that's one of them. But you think, yeah, really, who was the first person who pulled a sweet potato out of the ground and thought to make booze out of it?
Well, and of course, sweet potatoes are in the Caribbean, or, you know, they've been there forever, I think.
Yeah, that was a real early crop. You know, when Europeans were first settling the Caribbean and trying to figure out how to make use of its natural resources, we'll put it kindly that way, sweet potatoes was definitely one of the things that they found already being used there.
And as an aside, you had a little comment about yams, too, because there are hardly any yams, really, yams grown here in the U.S.,
it's a pet peeve of mine. You know, people say they're having yams at Thanksgiving. And trust me, you are not having a yam. You are having sweet potatoes. Yeah.
Yeah. And they might, from one can to the next, taste a little different, or from one producer to the next, they might taste a little different. But that's probably mostly the syrup, or however they're canned.
Right. As some people think that the one with the orange flesh is a sweet potato and the other one is a yam with the white flesh, or vice versa. None of that is true. They are all sweet potatoes.
Well, there are, and by the way, I haven't given the number, have I? Let me give the number. If you'd like to join in,
sure.
If you have a question or comment, what's your favorite cocktail? Do you know what plants you have to thank for that cocktail? And maybe you're able to pick out different flavors in your favorite spirits or cocktail. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's the number, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question or a comment. If you got a nice picture of a nice drink, you can post that there, too. So there are a couple of processes, right, in that are key, I guess you could say, to producing spirits from botanical raw materials?
Well,
it's fermentation and distillation, essentially, isn't it?
Well, yeah, basically. So, you know, with fermentation, all we're doing is taking sugar, which plants make lots of sugar, right? I mean,
yeah.
plants store sugar in their roots, like with sweet potatoes, like we were just talking about, and in fruit and in grains. They turn it into starch, so it'll keep a little bit longer, but it's still sugar. And in the case of sugar cane, they even just keep it in the stalk of the plant. And all you do is you take that sugar and you feed it to yeast organisms. So yeast have two waste products that they excrete, carbon dioxide, so that's the bubbles in, you know, beer or champagne, and alcohol, ethyl alcohol.
Yep.
So really, when you go home tonight and have a little drink after dinner, you are basically just drinking the waste products of microscopic yeast organisms. That's what you're drinking.
That's one way to put it.
Lovely, right?
Oh, man. So that's it, but there's...
That's fermentation,
yeah.
Sure. And then distillation, you're basically, again, I'm vastly oversimplifying, but what you're essentially doing is then boiling that mixture. And when the heat reaches the boiling point of the ethyl alcohol, then the alcohol lifts up out of the solution in the form of steam, and it gets caught in the still and condenses, sort of the way steam condenses in the lid of a pot if you're boiling water. And that's the alcohol, and you pour that off and bottle it, and there's your vastly oversimplified booze-making process.
Kevin in Whitewater, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Great.
Good. Okay, a few years ago, we were in southern France, southeastern France, Grenoble area.
Yep.
And some friends took us to a distillery there where they make chartreuse. And
yes.
The distillery is owned by a order of monks, I believe it is. And does your guest have any idea of what this is then?
Oh, I bet you do. I know you do.
I do actually, you know, and I have been there myself, and as I'm sure your caller knows, it's a somewhat of a Disney-fied kind of experience going to the Chartreuse Distillery. They give you a tour, but they don't let you see how anything is really being made. They claim to use 130 different herbs and you know other plants in their liqueur, but they won't tell you what they are. But see, here's what I did after I left the Chartreuse Distillery. I went to another smaller distillery a few hours away that makes the exact same style. So it turns out that these green and yellow liqueurs like Chartreuse makes is actually just one of many of a similar style being made across southern France, northern Spain, and into Italy. And at the smaller family-run distillery, they had no secrets. They were happy to show me how they made it, and they had a big barrel full of dried plant matter. And I looked in the barrel, and they said, oh, there's our secret blend of herbs and spices. So I took a picture of that. I can give a lot of good guesses. I would expect there to be a lot of lemon verbena in there. I taste angelica. There's definitely citrus. There's probably chamomile. There may well be a little bit of gentian, which is grown there. And, you know, if it really is 130 different plants, then basically you name it, they're putting it in there.
That's the one thing we were amazed at is they were trying to describe what goes into it, and I got lost. My French isn't that good. And then when we tasted it, they forgot to tell us that it has a very flowery aroma, and it kind of tastes like perfume.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
It's a bit much on its own. It's lovely mixed in a cocktail, although, of course, they expect you to drink it on their own. I think the people at Chartreuse were very surprised when they found out that bartenders in the United States were mixing cocktails with this stuff.
I would say. Well, Amy Stewart's going to be with us right up until 12:30, so we'll have a little news, and then we'll be back with her. Stay with us. Well, whether it's a brandy Manhattan, a rum punch, or a delicious mug of beer, all of our favorite beverages started with plants. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. My guest today until 12:30, Amy Stewart, the author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. She does an amazing job of telling the history of how different spirits and cocktails came to be, and what flowers, leaves, the roots, and seeds make them possible. Plus, she has a lot of great stories to share and some drink recipes as well. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments and experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Don't forget to check our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for updates and to post your questions and comments. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back with Amy right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, having some fun talking with Amy Stewart, award-winning author. She's several books out on the perils of and pleasures of the natural world, including three New York Times bestsellers, Wicked Bugs, Wicked Plants, and Flower Confidential. Her latest book is The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. And she joins us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Milwaukee. And once again, Amy, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
We have callers online have been waiting a while. I want to go to Chris in Trempealeau. Chris, hi. Thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Great.
I just wanted to mention I took a trip to Germany right after high school, and while I was over there, I was introduced to a liqueur that my dad had told me about from when he was in the Guards called Applecorn. And I remember when I got back on the plane with my friend to come back to the States, we had 8 bottles. When we landed in the States, it tasted so good there was none left.
Apfel. Well, Apfel is apple, right? German for apple?
That's correct.
Yeah, definitely. And you can still get it. I see it in liquor stores. So it's just one of many kind of apple brandies or apple liqueurs made throughout Europe. And that one in particular, if I'm remembering it right, is an apple brandy base, but with some additional you know, apple in it and some sugar to make it more like a liqueur than a straight brandy. But good stuff. The Europeans, they know what to do with their fruit.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Terry in North Lake. Hi.
I had tasted, I think it was, a liqueur some years ago when I was in California, and it was from somebody's, like, private stock. It was quite potent and real heavy flavor of licorice or anise. Hmm. But I don't know the name of it.
A Spanish spirit.
I think it was Spanish. Pretty sure it was Spanish.
Yeah, well, you know what? There's a lot of them. So, of course, in France, we think about absinthe and also pastis. And okay. Well, if it's pastis, then lovely anise spirit. So if you like the taste of licorice, you will like pastis. Sort of a pale green color, and you add water to it, and it gets cloudy as the plant molecules sort of break out of suspension, and you can see them a little bit better. But there's actually something also that they make in Spain that's a mixture of sloe berries and an anise-flavored spirit that you find in northern Spain. So it's interesting. These traditions kind of bleed over into those adjacent countries like that.
Very interesting.
Do you have a spelling on that pastis?
Oh, P-A-S-T-I-S.
Oh, quite easy.
Yeah.
Okay.
just like it sounds.
Thanks, Terry.
Okay. Thank you.
And kind of along, just as an aside here, I watch the Food Channel, you know, fairly often I'll have it on, and they always talk about anise.
Yes.
And is anise? I thought, isn't that anise? Is anise something different?
No. I think it's just one of those, you know, you say tomato, I say tomato kind of things. But no, it's the same thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's good to know. Facebook question from Peggy. Where do the bitters for an old-fashioned come from? That's a great story that you have in your book about that.
Yeah, actually, so the traditional bitters to use in an old-fashioned would be Angostura bitters,
yep.
and they are now made in Trinidad,
yep.
Although they were made in Venezuela. And the primary ingredient you would think would be the bark of the Angostura tree, given the name, mm-hmm. but they claim no Angostura bark in their formulation, and it was actually the subject of a really legendary trademark dispute. It turns out that you can't trademark the name of something if you're just describing what it is. So like leather shoes, you can't trademark that because that's just saying what kind of shoes they are.
Yep.
So the only way they could keep their name Angostura Bitters was to tell the judge there's actually not any Angostura in it. That's not why we're calling it that. And believe it or not, they won on that basis. And no one else can use that term, even if they're making bitters from Angostura bark.
It's a great story. I lived in Trinidad for a year, so I
did. You really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I spent a lot of time and tasted Angostura bitters many times.
In
Trinidad. And wasn't it? It was a doctor, wasn't it? Who's the story
doctor,
goes?
Yes, Dr. Siegert originally was the sort of founder, and you know, it's been this family run business for a long time. And he was supposedly treating people for various ailments using his famous bitters. It's sort of interesting that he claimed his bitters would treat fevers and stomach upsets, which are the very things that Angostura bark can be used to treat. And yet somehow no Angostura bark in the stuff. It does contain gentian root. They put that on the label, and then it contains a secret blend of herbs and spices. These people love their secrets, so sometimes we just have to guess at the ingredients.
Dennis and Seymour, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Years ago, my grandfather had told me that when he was in the northern Wisconsin logging camps, they would make what he called moonshine out of pine needles. You know if pine needles were ever used or are used in any liquor?
Well, yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. So you certainly could not actually ferment them. I mean, pine needles themselves do not contain enough sugar to actually make alcohol from. But you could add them to alcohol for flavoring. And that's actually done with other conifers. So there's a little chapter in the book on spruce tip beer. Douglas fir has been used. And in France, there is a pine liqueur in Alsace made from the stone pine. So it's not that uncommon to put, you know, sort of the needles of conifer trees into booze.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And by the way, you can join in too. Have open lines finally, and we can get you on fairly quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And this here we got a comment that goes with a photo on Facebook. So take a look at my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show for that. But Michael says, as a home brewer, I'm very aware of the use of hops. Even hops vary from crop to crop. You know, here's a photo of a dried hop flower or flowers from my front yard. And he says, take care to keep your dogs away from these plants. They can be deadly. Comment on that.
Huh. You know, I'm not aware of hops being deadly for dogs. So that's not something I'd heard of. And you would think I would know. I mean, having written a book on poisonous plants, my ears always perk up when I hear about something that's potentially toxic. I can imagine that they would be very irritating. You know, the thing about hops is that they're covered with these little spines and you really get a rash handling them.
Yeah.
And I imagine a dog taking a big mouthful would end up with a really swollen, kind of unhappy sort of rash. But I will look into that. I wasn't aware of it.
Got a problem. An email from Mike wondering, what about the drink called absinthe?
Yes.
Also known as green fairy with wormwood oil in it.
Right, right. So so absinthe is also one of these licorice-flavored drinks like pastis. But in addition to having anise or fennel or another sort of licorice-flavored herb in it, it also contains wormwood, Artemisia absinthum is the Latin name. And this is a Mediterranean herb with a kind of a bitter eucalyptus sort of menthol flavor. And it is true that wormwood contains a compound called thujone, which at very high doses could cause seizures. Mm. But nothing like that level of dosage ends up in a bottle of absinthe. So all those rumors about absinthe making people go crazy turned out not to be true at all. It's just that absinthe used to be bottled at 80% alcohol, so twice as much alcohol as gin or vodka. So people were probably just, you know, it was probably just alcohol poisoning more than anything else.
Teresa in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you about a friend of mine's mother used to make what she called cherry bounce.
Yeah.
And it was, what they would do is they had choke cherries. And they would soak them in Everclear with some sugar in it for about 6 weeks. And then they had to find just the right time to stop it so that the large seeds in the choke cherries wouldn't start flavoring it. But she called it cherry bounce because she said if you drank too much of it, you'd bounce off the walls.
And, you know, cherry bounce is a very popular thing here in Wisconsin, especially out of Door County, where we have so many cherry producers.
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, that is kind of the classic recipe, and it really can be just that simple. Everybody has their different methods. I mean, some people will take fruit and slowly simmer it with sugar to sort of release the juices and then mix that with alcohol. Other people put the raw fruit straight in, but sure, that's one way to do it.
Thanks, Teresa. Judy and Bloomer, hello.
Hi. My question follows right up with that question. Last year, about this time, we were on the Amalfi Coast in Italy, and I've always loved limoncello, which comes from there, and I'm able to make limoncello from a recipe I received from there. But I discovered melancello, which tastes like it's made from cantaloupe. And I'm wondering if you have any idea how that would be made, because with the limoncello, you use just the yellow part of the peeling to get the flavor.
Right, but right.
You couldn't do that with a cantaloupe, could you?
Right. If you wanted to do something like that with a soft summer fruit like a cantaloupe, or even for that matter, strawberries or something else that's sort of a soft, mushy fruit, plums or peaches, the only difference is that you need to only keep the fruit in the alcohol for maybe even just a day or two. you know, go ahead and kind of mush it up to release the juice and give it a day or two to soak. But if you leave it in for too long, then you'll start to get some really off flavors that are pretty unpleasant. So strain it out and then mix it with your simple syrup, and you'll make something pretty nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds good. Because with the lemon peelings, they just get crisp like potato chips, and you can just, you know, take them on with your hands.
Yeah.
With the citrus, you can leave it in a lot longer, but anything soft and tender really can only stay in for a short period of time.
Oh, good. I'm going to try this.
All right, Judy. Yeah, thanks, Judy. Thank you for calling. And let's turn to Dick in Bark River, Michigan. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I have a comment and a recommendation. It's a liqueur, the essence of honeydew melon. I think some people know, but a lot of people would really love it. It must be Midori brand, Midori, like the violinist. Which
yep.
Except no substitutes. And by the way, I was in Angostura, Venezuela, and it's now called Ciudad Bolivar, but that's a different story. Plus getting the absinthe out of Czechoslovakia before it joined the European Union. I don't know if that was legal or not, but that was 20 years ago. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Midori?
Yes, that's a melon. Really, that's just about the only melon product you can get in a bottle out there. But as your previous caller pointed out, when melons are in peak season, it's fantastic to use them fresh in a drink. So if you can stand to wait until summer, that's really the best time to try that.
Judith's had it. This is very sweet and tasty. Sweet and tasty. What about Bill and Caroline? What have you got for us today?
Well, I've got a question. I was in the Army in the mid-60s in Germany, and we had a blue-colored liquor that was really pretty potent. We could light it on fire, and I believe it was called Escorial. Hmm. Is there something like that available that you know of?
A blue liquor.
No.
And it tasted good. It wasn't like the blue stuff they make for daiquiris or margaritas. That stuff's terrible tasting. This was tasted really, really good, but it was very strong.
It's not ringing a bell. The other blue thing you're thinking of is blue Curacao, which does not have to be blue. That's just food coloring they add. But I will tell you that in Germany there's a real strong tradition of these very strong digestifs or bitters, and Jägermeister is an example of those. But there are a lot of other ones, and what you're describing sounds like one of those, but not one that I've tried.
Hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we tried drinking all their beer, and we couldn't do that either.
You gave it your best shot.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks a lot for calling. Speaking of drinking, you have an event tonight. It's co-sponsored by the Friends of the Berner Botanical Garden.
Yes.
And it's held at the Great Lakes Distillery on Virginia Street.
I know. I'm so excited about this. I mean, I was originally in touch with Boswell Books about coming out to do an event at the store, and they said, well, hey, why don't we do this at a distillery instead? And we'll just bring the books, and that way everybody can have a drink, and we can talk about it while we're looking at it. So that's what we're going to do.
I think that is absolutely great, and I wish I could be there again tonight.
Oh,
I wish I could, but
it should be fun.
Oh, it should be a lot of fun. So it's at the Great Lakes Distillery. It's on at 616 West Virginia Street in Milwaukee. And I'm not sure the timing. Do I have the time here? I'm not finding the time.
7 o'clock?
7 o'clock, is that what you have? Okay.
7 o'clock, yep.
So have a drink and talk about the book.
That's right. I'll give a talk about the book, and they will talk some about their lovely spirits that they've made, which, believe it or not, I have already tasted today.
you have to taste a sample.
I did, yes. Yes, part of my research, I actually had one of their gin and tonics. I did not have the entire gin and tonic. I should say I had a sip of one of their gin and tonics at 9 a.m. this morning.
Oh, how was it?
Lovely. They make their own tonic syrup, so very fresh. Not that awful cheap you know, artificial flavored stuff. This is the real deal.
You talk about tonics in your book, actually, don't you? Makings? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Quinine. So the bark of the cinchona tree, which quinine, you know, is a malaria treatment and is also what flavors tonic water.
And so there's good tonic and there's not so good tonic.
That's right. Yeah, I'm a little bit of a tonic water snob. So if you can't be at a place like Great Lakes tonight where they make their own, there are a couple of very good, high-quality brands of tonic water out there. But the cheap stuff, try drinking it by itself and you will realize, oh, I should never put this in a drink.
Brad in Rice Lake, hello.
Hi there. Great show, you guys.
Thanks.
My mad scientist in me has this question about the rage of flavoring your own vodka. All the flavored vodkas these days. And what suggestions you might have, or if it's possible to flavor my own if I just got a regular, decent vodka and wanted to flavor it to whatever I chose.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. You can definitely do your own flavored vodkas. Get a nice mid-range vodka. Don't get the rock-bottom cheap stuff. How long you leave the plants in depends on what kind of plant it is. So if you're using fresh green herbs like basil, things that are tender and green, just a day or two. The same with soft, fresh fruit like we were talking about earlier, or tomatoes. Anything soft and mushy should only stay in for a couple of days. But citrus peel and spices can stay in vodka for up to a month. So if you want to do a blend, do each one separately for however long it needs to stay in, and then play mad scientist and blend them up to get the flavor that you want. That's the trick.
That's the trick.
Yes.
Sounds like fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. Yes. And while we're at it, you had some great stories about vodka and potatoes in your little history in your book.
Yes, that's right. You know, I mean, some people think that vodka only comes from potatoes, but you have to keep in mind that vodka was being made in Russia and Poland before they ever knew what a potato was, because a potato is a New World crop, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't until it got to Poland and they ran out of other things to make vodka with that they tried making it out of potatoes. It's actually not that easy to do. Potatoes are pretty tricky to work with. So, and Russians really look down on it. They believe that vodka ought to be made from grains, and they sort of look down their nose at Polish potato vodka. But, of course, there's excellent potato vodkas out there today. So I actually had a vodka party where we had a dozen different vodkas made from different plants, and we lined them up and let people sample them.
Wow.
You can make vodka from just about anything, as it turns out.
Boy, by the time you got to number 12.
I'm telling you, the research for this book was grueling. But I had a little help from my friends, as you can imagine.
Oh, man. Kelly and Ashland, hi.
Hi, I've got a question about Druid herbs, which a homebrewing friend tells me predates the use of hops in making beer. I don't know if you could tell me anything about that.
Druid.
Yes, right. Yeah, you are exactly right. Hops were not really the first flavoring to be used in beer. I mean, they're really useful because not only do they change the flavor, but they also act as a preservative. But that didn't happen until about 800 AD. And we were making beer. I mean, you know, beer was pretty much the first thing that we ever tried to do.
Yeah.
So wormwood, meadowsweet, yarrow was used. A lot of different things were used, not just to change the flavor, but also to try to help preserve it. You can imagine what a bummer it would be to go down into your basement in the middle of winter and pull out your last cask of beer and find out it had spoiled. Nobody wants to. I know, it's grim, right? So that was a big issue, and hops really helped with that.
Amy, this is it's always so much fun to have you on the show, and I want to remind everybody, you can continue the conversation with Amy Stewart at an event in Milwaukee. It's co-sponsored by the Friends of Berner Botanical Gardens, held at the Great Lakes Distillery. It's located on 616 West Virginia Avenue in Milwaukee. So Great Lakes Distillery, 7 o'clock. And you can have a drink and talk about drinks and plants. Amy, it's great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
We'll do it again, I hope.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Thank you so much. Amy Stewart joined us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Milwaukee. The name of her book, The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Really a fun and interesting read. General Contractors Ken Adams and John Freiberger join us tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.